Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with award-winning journalist, urban critic, lecturer, and author Roberta Gratz. Her most recent book is We're Still Here, Ya Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City, published by Nation Books in June 2015. Roberta has also written The Battle for Gotham, New York in the Shadow of Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. Earlier works include the now classic The Living City, Thinking Small in a Big Way, and Cities Back from the Edge, New Life for Downtown. Ms. Gratz is an international lecturer on urban development issues and former award-winning reporter for the New York Post, when the New York Post was a good newspaper. She also wrote a report in 2001 for the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, A Frog, a Wooden House, a Stream, and a Trail, 10 Years of Community Revitalization in Central Europe. Ms. Gratz's articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, The Nation, Tikkun, Planning Magazine, New York Newsday, The Daily News, Planning Commissioner's Journal, and others, and her writing has been translated into Japanese, Russian, Czech, German, and Polish. Roberta Gratz was appointed by Mayor Michael Bloomberg to the New York City Landmark Preservation Commission in 2003, and in 2010 resigned from the commission and was then appointed by the mayor to serve on a sustainability advisory board for Plan NYC. In 2005, in collaboration with Jane Jacobs, Ms. Gratz and a small group of accomplished urbanists founded the Center for the Living City, and she travels frequently all over the U.S., Central Europe, Japan, and Great Britain to lecture and consult on urban revitalization issues. Roberta Gratz is a trustee and former head of public policy of the New York State Preservation League, former vice president of the Salzburg Conference on Urban Planning and Development, founder and president emeritus of the Eldridge Street Museum, the effort to restore the historic Eldridge Street Synagogue on the Lower East Side and to establish a Jewish Heritage Center on the site, a founder and current board member of the Writers' Room, the first urban writers' colony in the country. We'll talk to Roberta Gratz about all of this and much more, but first, welcome, Roberta Gratz.
It's good to be here.
Well, you and I have a sort of common background. We're both Fire Islanders. How important was that to you?
It's very important. Well, I came as because my cousins were there full-time, and I would only come to visit during the summer. But as an adult, married adult, we bought our own house and raised our own kids there.
And then you got to be really quite a big shot. You got to be a trustee of Ocean Beach Fire Island.
Well, and, if you call that a big shot,
right,
yes.
And then and you worked with the Ocean Beach Youth Group, which my mother founded, and right. You did all of these wonderful things. But you traveled the world, always looking to make better cities.
That's absolutely true, but there's nothing more important than your own backyard. So Fire Island was my backyard. I got involved in all the squabbles of the day, and they seem not so big to outsiders, but locally, you know, those things are very important.
Yeah, people have great passions. Anybody who lives in a New York City co-op knows that.
Well, I always felt that that since Fire Island was primarily populated by people who wintered in New York City,
sure,
who felt totally removed from their government, right? But then they got to Fire Island,
yeah.
Ocean Beach, where they
were actually, 1 out of 200, not 1 out of 8 million.
They could go to a trustee meeting and yell.
Yeah.
And they did.
And there were great wars on Fire Island.
Oh, like, absolutely.
Like whether or not somebody should be allowed to eat an ice cream cone on the street and made the front page of the New York Times, I believe.
That was the best. It was actually the chocolate chip cookie incident that we all talk about, and it was one of those things where it was called a slow news day at the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
And the reporter, the Long Island reporter, happened to be in court that day, and the reality was
in court on Fire Island,
on Fire
presided
Island,
presided over
weekly.
By Judge Benjamin Mailman,
right. But you know, let's remember, everybody walked barefoot, so the
we
rule
sure.
was really about preventing people from walking around with drinks, and then there were no go cups in those days. They were, you know, glasses and bottles and things. And if they broke, people
sure.
were walking barefoot. So there was a rule that you couldn't eat on the sidewalks.
But there are always in governments things like intervening variables. Something changes. In the case of Fire Island, it became a national seashore.
Right.
And all kinds of things happened as a result of that. And for example, in front of everybody's house, instead of a little sand, was now a giant fence to keep the deer out, because shooting deer on Fire Island is no longer permitted.
Well, the fence is an individual thing. The fence on the beach to, you know, help build up the dune is one thing. But individual deer fences are totally private. And in fact, in front of my own house, I have no fence. I fence in the back of the house where I have some plantings and I have a little garden. But they walk freely in my front yard. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have very landscaped, property, so they put fences around it.
Yeah, but these fences are something we didn't really see in the old days.
That's right, and they're actually mostly built inappropriately so that they're really walling off the pedestrian in a way that's diminishing in terms of the environment. But some people do it in as big a opening fence as visually opening as possible, and that's okay. But they should be set back more and should be more visible for the passerby.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this incredible latest book of yours, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. We're still here, you bastards. Why'd you name it that?
As you can imagine, the title is very popular in New Orleans. The reality was, this was a real graffiti, and it emerged right after Katrina. Uh-huh. Because there were all these experts from all over the country and in the policy levels of the city and state questioning whether the city should be rebuilt. I mean, Dennis Hastert in Congress said, you know, who says the city should be rebuilt at all? I mean, people were actually questioning whether this should happen. And it infuriated local people. They were already, many of them were already back cleaning out their homes and rebuilding. How dare anyone say you shouldn't come home? So this young couple put up the sign on the outside of their store. It was a bike shop. We're still here, you bastards. And a friend of mine, good friend of mine, caught a picture of it. And in the first draft of the introduction to this book, I quoted a number of the graffitis. They were wonderful because, if you remember, there was no communication possible. All lines were down. So the communication of choice was graffiti. And, I mean, one guy had two refrigerators out front, which you never wanted to open your refrigerator after all that. So he had two refrigerators out front, and he'd say, "Our twin towers," you know, and there were all these things. And this was one of the messages. And when my editor read that, he said, "That's it. That's the title." And I said, "Oh, I'm not so sure." But I lived with it while I was writing the book, tried it on a lot of people, and especially down there, they just loved it. And it was the sentiment of the people of New Orleans that they were determined to make their city viable again and come back home.
Now, my son, Jonas, lives on Laurel, which is parallel to the magazine street you write about in your book. And we took a tour when we were down there visiting him. We went on a Katrina tour several years ago, and it was supposed to be a lot of people on the bus, but it was only Roselle and I. And the guy took us all around, and, you know, it was pretty depressing. 1 to 10, how far have we come back?
It depends on where in the city you're talking about and for whom.
The famous Ninth Ward.
The lower Ninth Ward, which I write a whole chapter about, is better than most people realize, because if you go into the lower Ninth Ward now for the first time, you will say, "What are they talking about? This is very discouraging. There's a lot of emptiness." You have to understand what was really wiped out, and you have to understand how difficult the financial and bureaucratic impediments are to returning, so that it's been slow. But you go through every time, and I've been in and out of there many times each year, and there's always something being built. Now, it's spotty, often clusters. You figure either some developer has built a couple of rental houses, or a family has rebuilt their little family compound, of which there were many before Katrina. And you go to the Brad Pitt houses, the Make It Right houses. It's fantastic. And it really looks like a neighborhood. And it has helped inspire other people to come back and rebuild. Now, if you know anything about how cities are reborn, and this is the fifth book that I've written on this subject in one form or another, it does not happen overnight. Even if it's one big developer, doesn't happen overnight. And if it is one big developer, it's the wrong way because it doesn't reflect the people who are really moving back. And I love to cite the interview in my book of an elderly woman who sadly has since passed, but she was the first woman back. She and her best friend and neighbor were the first to rebuild with the help of Acorn and LSU architects and a bank. And when I interviewed her, I said, "Aren't you concerned that you're moving into a place that's so empty?" And she leaned forward and she said, "Honey, when we got here in 48, there was nobody. The walks were oyster shells. We had a 45-minute walk to church or to the bus, but they came and they will come. Trust me, they will come."
So you're an expert on the revitalization of cities. I wanted to ask you this. For a long time, I've been saying, and I don't think in jest, that as soon as when the fires hit the Bronx and when the South Bronx looked so terrible, I said, somebody's going to make a lot of money on this. And indeed, that's exactly what's beginning to happen now. You know, you're a few minutes from Times Square on a subway. I always have the sense, maybe I'm just a little too paranoid, that there's a guiding hand behind the way this all works out.
You're not paranoid, although I have to say, as someone who has been paranoid in many ways, paranoia is more closely to the truth than we often realize. The South Bronx, you're going to my first book, The Living City, Thinking
Indeed.
Small in a Big Way. And what I show in that book is how the Bronx got rebuilt. What I also show is how it became devastated. And it was not natural. It was not the fault of the victims of the South Bronx. There were policies and there were civic leaders in City Hall that were purposely abandoning the South Bronx, the banks, the insurance companies. It was all very deliberate.
To what end?
It was a policy called planned shrinkage. The end was to direct the investment into the more established areas, just like today. The money goes into the neighborhoods that are not the ones most in need.
And Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, ran on a fairness doctrine in terms of making sure that everybody got a break and a place to live. And his message is not resonating well with the people of New York.
Because he's well-meaning and misguided. The policies he has in place are all based on investing in developers to do the right thing versus investing in the people who are already there in helping to add to those communities rather than replace buildings. We're losing as many low-rent or modest-rent apartments as we are gaining, and the affordable housing standard that is being set is too expensive for most of the people being displaced. So this is definitely a problem, but it's classic. This happens everywhere.
Well, Roberta Gratz, you worked for Mike Bloomberg, and certainly he's not excused from this idea of having people develop apartments and things in New York City.
Well, let's say I was a volunteer in the administration. I was not a paid member of the administration, which sometimes caused problems, because when I was on the Landmarks Commission and did what I felt was right, was not always what City Hall wanted. On the Sustainability Advisory Council, we were a voice, not a vote, and it was a very competent staff. I was critical of Bloomberg in my last book on the Robert Moses Jane Jacobs book, Battle for Gotham. I was critical and I was laudatory. I shouted out on the things that I thought were done well in the administration, particularly the work of Jeanette Sada Khan and the pedestrianizing of the city and the bike lanes and everything. And I was critical where it was appropriate. I mean, where the Atlantic Yards project in Brooklyn, which was just devastating and remains so today, had their support, as did the wiping out of the neighborhood of Willets Point, right adjacent to Citi Field. So the administration was not happy that I wrote the book at all, even though I said, listen, you know, this is who I am. You know who you were getting when you appointed me. And I wasn't on any paid positions.
So let's stop you right there. On the left-right spectrum, you know, the book is published by Nation Books, right? So I think we have to assume that they liked what you wrote and that you, on the left-right spectrum, would be closer to the left end of things than the right end.
You know, that's not necessarily true because these issues are not left-right issues.
Well, it's left-right when you're talking, Roberto. Let me fight with you about this for a second. It's left-right, isn't it, when you say either we should build for the richest people in New York City or we should make sure that everybody has a place to live. One could say if you're where you are and saying build extra apartments and where de Blasio is, that you're further to the left side.
There's no doubt I'm a liberal. However, when it comes to certain issues, for example, on eminent domain, the far right is much better than the left on eminent domain.
Now, eminent domain, the right for the state to take the land or the city to take the land. Explain that to us.
Well, it's the right to take the property, but it used to be for public purposes only. Now, and there was a big Supreme Court case a number of years ago, which expanded the right so that many municipalities take the land and turn it over to a private developer for either a shopping mall or for a housing development. The most important group fighting eminent domain around the country is a right-wing group in Washington. The left has been terrible on eminent domain. The fact is, Democratic politicians love eminent domain. And so on a lot of these issues, it's not a left-right issue. Everybody, left and right, is for affordable housing. How you do it is a different issue. And I have to say, the right and the left are in support of the developer more than local people. And the point is that if you really want to address gentrification, which is not bad of itself, what's bad is displacement of people who are of modest income and have been there for a while. If you want to address it, then there are policy solutions that direct the support to local property owners, whether they are the homeowner or the rental property owner willing to commit to a restricted increase schedule. No one on the left or right in the political spectrum is for doing it that way because the donors for campaigns are the ones who are the developers. So it's about where the money is. It's not where the politics are.
Is that true in New Orleans also?
Everywhere.
Well, let's go to New Orleans for a minute. We can come back here if we want. When one reads about New Orleans and what has happened there, one gets the feeling that Black people weren't treated particularly well after
Katrina. Absolutely. Well, in this particular issue, the chapter I have on public housing is a devastating condemnation of how it was done left, right, and center. The fact is the choice, the really public housing developments in New Orleans dating from the 1940s early were model red brick tile roof, iron railings buildings. No excuse for tearing them down physically. There was much testimony as to how they could have been restored appropriately. They were clearly run down. At any rate, long story short, and I have a whole chapter about this in the book, and it's classic because it's a national issue. They wanted it down, and public housing has been demolished since the 1970s. Reagan, Nixon, all those guys started starving the funds of public housing. And what has happened over the years is they've been replaced by private developments with public funds. This is the replacement of a public program for private money, supported by left, right, center all over the place. It's wrong because it always diminishes the number, whether you like the new, whether you like the old, the number of available public housing units is always diminished, and the number of vouchers that are given in replacement are never enough and never taking people to, shouldn't say never, you know, there's always the occasional wonderful dream story of somebody with a voucher living a better life. But in most cases, they have to move into already challenged neighborhoods. They have to find landlords willing to take a subsidized tenant. it's a system that's broken, and it's broken for the benefit of the private developer.
No, I buy it. But I want to tell you, Roberta Gratz, that there will be people listening to this who will say, wait a second. You know, I live near, quote, the projects or a project. It was a denizen of terrible things happening, crime, and that's why so many of these places got taken down in Albany, in New York City, and I'm sure in New Orleans, because they were terrible.
That was the excuse. Taking down buildings does not address social issues, does not address crime, the causes of crime, whatever they are not addressed by moving people around like chess pieces on a board, and they never get addressed.
So where do they go?
That's the point. They get dispersed.
And well, dispersed where? I mean, for example, you take down a project in New York City,
right?
All of a sudden...
Which doesn't happen in New York City,
well,
fortunately.
Well, it did for a little while, didn't it? Weren't there projects that got...
No, what they've done in New York, and it's a little more insidious, they let apartments remain vacant.
Right.
So it diminishes the number, but we have not yet reached the point where they're actually trying to replace it with private development.
Okay. So when you get rid of people, when they move, where do they go? I mean...
It's a good question.
Well, I know, because I never could figure that out. I mean, you know, what happens? You get white middle-class families moving to Harlem, and they pay fortune for a brownstone or something else, and then those people are displaced, and they go somewhere. Now, they've got to go somewhere. Where do they go?
You know, it's interesting, and I get into this a little bit in the book. If you go into the history of public housing in the early days from the 1940s and after the war, when it was really a lot for returning veterans, they were mostly for white people. And there were all sorts of social services and educational and play opportunities and, you know, things for the population, young and old. As the developments turned black, mostly in the late 50s and 60s, budgets got cut, services got cut. All the kind of things that actually address the issues were decimated. In the book, I show that there was a group out of Tulane in charge of...
Now we're back to
New Orleans
again,
out of Tulane, that were given authority over the public housing at one point and actually created and provided a workable solution in which they address the issues and help people actually become homeowners and save money and do all these things. That was not the purpose. That's never the purpose. It's about dispersing based on these false notions that by diminishing the density of a public housing project, you're going to diminish crime. Well, you know, if you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you. So these are issues which is often true in the urban development spectrum. These are issues that are articulated in ways that really distract from the real issue, not address.
So let me ask you something, Roberta Gratz. We're now going through revelatory times where it turns out we're finding out who gives the money to the politicians to make things go. And the real estate industry is right at the top, you
the
know,
biggest.
Of this. So it's sort of a fee-for-service thing, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it's really very upsetting. As somebody who was born and raised in New York and has been a New York booster for my already long life, I find it very discouraging. I come back from New Orleans to New York, and I'm not happy walking around as clearly a upper-income resident because I'm in an apartment for 40-some-odd years I couldn't afford today, but as, you know, right on Central Park West, I live in the surrounded by luxury that I would never be able to afford if I had to buy into it. But it's very distressing because real estate owns New York. The reality is whatever the issue is, it's the real estate voice that is predominant. Now, this has been building over the years. It's always been a factor. I can remember as far back as when Ed Koch was elected, the first ones in his office the next morning were a group representing the real estate industry. But they were one of a of a larger spectrum. Today, they are the spectrum. And I see it in many ways that I just find very unfortunate. It's not that they're bad people. Their interpretation of the public interest flows out of what they do. They don't have a dispassionate view of understanding how things work. What I write about is observing how things work and how cities function. When they function well, or they are reborn, or they fall apart. These are observable things. This is not the reality on which the real estate community bases their ideas. They are highly focused. They really believe they have the truth and that they are the saviors.
And their truth is?
Their truth is that if you encourage more building, even if it is for global money, for empty apartments,
Arab sheiks
or Russian oligarchs or whatever, somehow this is going to help the economy of the city. And here's the crux of their issue. We need to build the tax base. That's what they'll all tell you. But the irony is you build the tax base to give it away to them because all these new buildings are giving you know, tax-exempt status of one sort or another. And, of course, the famous ones are the big ones on 57th Street, the 90-story towers that Albany legislature approved because now those guys are supporting the upstate legislators. So there's legislation going through Albany that is affecting the New York real estate market, and it's out of control of New York City. So it's a real problem, and the worst thing that I think happened is that they cracked down on the Swiss bank account so that they're not as, invisible as they used to be because the money that used to get hidden in a Swiss bank account is now getting hidden in a $90, $100 million apartment in New York or even a $40 or $50 million apartment. It's skewing the whole market as well as our own homegrown billionaire, millionaire class. And it's not a problem that's exclusive to New York. London is experiencing the same kind of global investment. On the New Orleans side, New Orleans is getting a lot of new residents. They may be middle class, upper middle class, but the cost of living in New Orleans has gone sky high for those who don't earn enough to be able to afford it. And it's happening in other cities as well across the country. I mean, it's more a reflection of the national economic issue. The 1%, 99% issue is playing out in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, Chicago, you name it. It's a national issue, and it's playing out differently but harmfully in every city because it's just pushing out people who aren't making a living wage.
So let's play a little hardball here for a moment. You own that apartment on Central Park West?
I do.
It's worth a lot of money now, right?
I call it funny money because if I sell it and give its share to the federal government, then what do I do?
So do you feel bad about, you know, having all that wealth behind you? In other words, you didn't pay that when you bought it.
No, you know, I don't feel bad. You know why?
Why?
When we moved to the West Side, people thought we were nuts. We were among not the first wave, but the second wave of pioneers moving into urban neighborhoods when crime was high in the 70s. Let's remember the 1970s, late 60s and through the 70s were the worst time in New York and other cities.
Hey, I grew up on 96th Street.
Well, there
you
go.
And you and I are about the same age.
Right.
And we were there from day one. I didn't feel we were quite pioneers, but I did know that people would come over from 97th Street and steal our roller skates.
Oh, yes.
So that, you know, it was rough. And every one of the side streets between 86th and 96th.
Dangerous.
Those were regarded as slum.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, my kids went to school on the subway and they had to go in groups. It was kind of a hairy time. So, no, I feel we were just smart, number one.
Or lucky.
Smarter than lucky, because we bucked a trend. And in a lot of cities, this is true. But for a lot of people, what that means, fortunately, I can afford the increased real estate taxes. I can afford the increased living expenses. But in the neighborhoods of the cities that are being gentrified without any kind of modification, the people who have been there forever are often priced out of staying. And that's where the injustice comes
in. Well, but weren't you, you know, you use gentrification almost as a dirty word. Weren't you a gentrifier?
I don't use gentrification as a dirty word. I use displacement as a dirty word. Gentrification is basically good because if you're gentrifying a deteriorated neighborhood, you are help stabilizing it. Remember, what's the opposite of gentrification? Continued decay. The problem in a neighborhood being gentrified in which middle-class people are moving in among low-income people, the first steps is that it brings positive things. It brings customers to the local stores. It brings attention from City Hall, better sanitation, police, or whatever. But then it grows and it becomes out of balance. So gentrification of itself is not bad. In fact, it's good. It's the displacement of the people who are there that is bad. And I say in the book, and I've said this over and over again, and I've put it out as a challenge to policymakers, there are solutions. The solutions mean what I referred to before, investing in the local people, the local homeowner who can't manage the increased taxes. There should be deferred taxes for the local homeowner who would pay the deferred tax at the point of sale. So if you want to sell and cash in on the increase, great. That's your prerogative. If you want to stay, you have a limit on the increase in the taxes until the point you sell. If you are an owner of a rental property, if you will agree to maintain a limit on the rent increase, then you would get some kind of tax deferral the way they give it to developers. All I'm saying is if you want to be creative and you really want to address these issues, take the same principles in terms of giving funding benefits to developers and give it to the people in place. Problem is they are not your campaign donors.
That's right.
And that's the answer. It's not that there aren't solutions. It's that they're not the ones who necessarily give to campaigns, although they vote, which, you know, one would think in a democracy is more important than anything else. So gentrification is good if you address displacement.
There will be those of us who will say, I'm from Missouri. You know, prove it to me. I have always thought that, you know, like love and marriage, you can't have one without the other. So if you gentrify and you say, well, if we did this and we did this and we did this, everything would be all right, but we don't do this and this and this. So if we gentrify, they go, we don't know where. And as you said in the beginning, we don't even know where they go.
So we knew how to do this. And in my first book, I'm always happy to plug one of my other books, The Living City, I tell the story of the South Bronx. I tell the story of Savannah, Georgia. And in both cases, we were at a time of disinvestment in cities, not reinvestment in cities. And what secured the places before the more middle and upper class money came in was an approach that secured enough units in the place for either the people in place or the low-income, moderate-income people to move in, and then let the market take its course around it so that at least you're not trying to catch up after the gentrification takes place. You're securing early a number of units, either as public housing or as low-income co-ops or owned by community-based operations, not-for-profit operations. There are ways to do this. And then you let the market take its place, and you know what you come out with at the end? An economically and socially integrated community. And that is allegedly what everybody says they want.
Okay. Roberta Gratz, first of all, I want to remind everybody we're talking to Roberta Gratz, who probably knows more about cities than anybody we know. And the name of her new book, and she's written several, are How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. And the name of the book is We're Still Here, You Bastards. And it's by Roberta Gratz. Okay, so my mom, who I, you know, think of often, helped put up a major middle-income housing development between Columbus and Amsterdam Avenues, the Riverside Neighborhood Assembly House, and she thought it up. And when it was done, it had this great rule that was, you buy them cheap, but then when you get out, you have to sell them for what you got. Then
Mitchell-ama. That was Mitchell-ama.
Yeah. Then they, all the Mitchell-ama people got together and said, wait a second, these houses are worth a lot of money right now. We want the legislature to give us permission to sell them at market value. And the legislature said, now let's see now, held their hands up in the air and said, who was going to vote for us and who is not? And they gave away the store.
That's right.
Do whatever you want.
And in fact, I forget what the number is. It's several thousand, 3,000 or more units of moderate income housing we lost because of the Mitchell-ama privatization. And, you know, I don't blame the tenants of Mitchell-ama wanting to own something that, you know, they were lucky enough to invest in. But the reality is that was not the intent of the legislation and the financing. And if they, you know, hadn't done that, there was no danger of their being displaced. They were there for life, and many of them, their kids would inherit the right to live there because they had been a tenant. And they were basically protected for life. What they weren't was given, or wouldn't have been if they hadn't been privatized, they wouldn't have been given a gift of a considerable sum of money.
You bet.
And that was wrong. And that's been, you know, we're seeing the transformation of the biggest development in the city, Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper. We're losing the kind of housing we had and have not had the guts to come up with the legislation, you know, to preserve it.
And again, because there's somebody...
It's going to make money.
Immense amount of money to politicians.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, it's the same tale I've told in many different ways in each of my books. It was painful for me to watch this in New Orleans because the group that was hurt the most were the most vulnerable. And I have to say, you know, the inspiration of the book was watching Katrina unfold on TV and saying to myself, oh, boy. You know, this is a story with my name on it. How was this going to unfold? From the top down or from the bottom up? And so I moved down there, particularly with the idea, or moved down there part-time, to embed myself in the city, get to know the city and the people, and to watch how it happened. And the good news, a lot of good stuff happened because those people dug their heels in and said, no way, and we're going to do it, and we're still here, you bastards, and we ain't leaving. But a lot of bad things came down from up above. Public housing was one. A terrible story with the closing of the hospital and the rebuilding of a totally unnecessary, uneconomical replacement. There were crime issues, school issues, all of these things played out very differently. And the interesting thing was to watch that it became a much more transparent political process, more engaged. The public got more engaged and got listened to. However, as I say at the end of the book, even this is beginning to erode. There's some question as to some of the elected officials, particularly on the city council, who came out of the neighborhoods, who now eye the office of mayor, of whether or not they're really going over to the dark side or championing the people who actually elected them.
Now, there's so much ancillary stuff. For example, it is my impression that most of the schools in New Orleans are charter schools. Why is that?
Well, you know, it was disaster capitalism issues, which the book is filled with. That's the underbelly of the post-Katrina story is how many things happened that could never have happened politically, including the public housing and the hospital and the transportation, which got privatized, and the schools, politically could never have happened to the degree that they have. So, yes, New Orleans is probably the largest dominated charter school city in the country. It's the one chapter in which I'm somewhat ambivalent because there are a lot of good things. It would be hard not to improve on what it was because it was really a broken system. And things are not as great as the proponents would like you to believe. So it is a mixed bag, but it's very much a non-public school system. It's a basically private school system with public money. And this is, you know, like the development world.
So, Roberta Gratz, I want to name some names, and I want you to tell me what your investigation has shown about these people. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
George Bush. George W. Bush.
Well, the most interesting thing about George Bush and the Katrina story, I mean, everybody knows how poorly he reacted and waited a couple of days after the disaster to fly over and look down.
And tell his man, Brownie, you're doing a hell of a job.
Yes, and all of which, you know, was very publicly addressed. But the worst part about the Bush administration is in an area of the book that I spell out about the contracts. Because everybody talks about these billions that went to New Orleans after Katrina. And I maintain that of the billions, maybe 20% hit the ground. Because everything was contracted out to private contractors. There was no government. FEMA, all those people, they were contracts in which tons of money was being made. Debris removal, blue tarps for the roofs, everything you name. And you would have something like the blue tarps, which would have cost like $175 a square in a contract to the first contractor, who subcontracted to the next guy for $130, and then to the next guy for $90. And maybe the guy putting up the square, $2. So when you start doing the math and you look at all the contracts that I outline in the book, these are all Bushies. These are all politically connected to Haley Barbour in Mississippi and to, you know, the political firms that, you know, run these things. So to me, that's the biggest sin of the Bush administration. The fact that he didn't respond in the way that Lyndon Johnson did after Betsy, where he showed up the next day and said, I'm here to help. What can I do? You know, it was a stark contrast. Plus the fact that Karl Rove, who is such a mastermind at manipulating things to make them look black when they're white, mastermind a whole thing to make it look like Governor Blanco was responsible, the only female Democratic governor left in the South. She was no angel, but she was not what they tried to depict, and I outline this in the book. So that's my short answer for George Bush.
Talk to me about the political class in New Orleans. Who suffered as a result of what happened? In other words, you had a mayor, he fell into disrepute. What happened?
Well, the people who got hurt the most in New Orleans are primarily African-American, low-income. And there are all sorts of reasons for this, too complicated to go into now, but I spell them out in the book in terms of the kind of money that they got in relief and a number of things on which it was based that basically government did not trust them to be able to handle money. Essentially, that's what it was. And so they were paid poorly. They were paid through the banks. So that if you were entitled to money and you had a mortgage, the bank took its money for the mortgage and you were left with the crumbs. So those are the people who got hurt. The politics of this city, you know, you need a roadmap and it's very complicated. So the mayor at the time, Ray Nagin, he's in jail. We all know that, corruption, all that stuff. But there are things that the way New Orleans work. Listen, you know, I tell my friends in New Orleans, hey, you guys, you get a bad rap, but, you know, come to Albany. I mean, here we got, I'm listening on the radio. We got Silver and we've got, you know, Skelos. And I'm saying, my God, you know, New Orleans, you should be patting yourself on the back. And you go to Illinois, you go wherever. I mean, corruption is not reserved for New Orleans or Louisiana. The difference in New Orleans is often it's more front page when it's black.
Well, what will happen if there's another major hurricane of this type? I notice on Fire Island, which you both know well, people are now building on stilts in their houses. Is that going on in New Orleans? And if it is, what are the chances that New Orleans comes up a lot better than it did last time?
First of all, that is happening not everywhere. And I have to say that I raised my house on Fire Island. I'm now 4.5 feet higher than it was. Because, you know, if you have half a brain and you know what global warming is doing, the seas are rising. The main thing about New Orleans and the hurricane is one has to realize it was not the hurricane. It was not the flood. It was a federal disaster. It was the break of the levees. 53 places on the levees in New Orleans broke. The storm was over. The water was receding. And everybody was walking around, hey, we beat the bullet. And suddenly the water came from they didn't know where because the levees started breaking. So
exactly what is a levee?
A levee is what protects the city. It's like a wall built along the canals and the lakefront to keep the rising water from coming into the city.
Now, the lakefront you're referring to is Lake Pontchartrain.
Yes.
Which is huge. When I first saw it, I couldn't believe it. It looked like you were looking over the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. But the real problem is from the canals. And for $14 billion, the Corps of Engineers repaired their mistakes. And allegedly now, the levee system is in order.
Do you believe them?
Yeah, of course I believe them because you can see the rebuilt levee. The real question is, what about the areas that didn't break? So we know what's been rebuilt. We don't know what condition is the areas that have not been rebuilt. But the vulnerable areas seem to have been rebuilt, and chances are that will protect the city. If there are floods, you know, New Orleans has experienced floods since the 18th century. The houses were built to absorb and water and get rid of it quickly. That's why there's Cypress, and they all built slightly above ground, at least the smart ones. So a lot of people are doing the right re-engineering of their homes, and the Brad Pitt houses are a perfect example of this. So if you recognize that it was not the hurricane, but the Corps of Engineers' inappropriate building of the levees, then you can feel pretty confident.
That when the next one comes, New Orleans will be better off.
It will certainly be better off, and the real danger, which is always the case in a lot of big storms, is the wind. And that, you know, the government can't control that.
So you have this hodgepodge. You have education, you have housing, you have public housing, you have a different political class that is in charge.
You have crime is as bad as ever.
Yes, and it was for a long time the homicide capital of the world, or of the country anyway. And you had at least a few politicians, as you said, Dennis Hastert and others, saying, why rebuild it? It's a mess. Why rebuild it?
Oh, well, that's easy. One could write a whole book on the significance of the port of New Orleans for the entire country. Remember, we're the end of the Mississippi. We're the gateway to the West. There are figures, I never have them in my head, but the percentage of fish and shipping goods and oil and everything that comes through that port. You know, hello, Dennis. Where would you get all those things if there was no port of New Orleans? Yeah, there are other ports, but the whole Southeast is more vital to the national economy health than people realize. And I try to explain this to some extent in the book so that we understand, forget the celebratory culture, the food, the music, the architecture, forget all the things that everybody already loves. Talk about the bricks and mortar of an economy. We'd be pretty crippled without New Orleans.
Well, when Roselle and I go to New Orleans, you've just mentioned one of the great reasons for going, which is food. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
And you know what? There are more restaurants now than there were before Katrina.
Is that because of the tourist class?
I think so. My big criticism of the current mayor is that for him, the only thing of great importance is more and more tourism, so that it's really infringing on the life of the city and the cost of the city, and prices have risen even in restaurants. And when I first started going, I mean, I tell people I save money living there for 5 months of the year than from New York. And for, you know, one meal in New York, I eat for two in New Orleans. Well, that's less and less true.
Yeah, you got Commander's Palace. All I know is when we go to visit our son, we pay. And
of course.
And they're pretty expensive. Some of those restaurants are pretty expensive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But there are more of them. And if you're local and you know where to go that is not where the tourists go, there's some terrific little places in my neighborhood that nobody would know to go to. And those are the places that, you know, you depend on when you live there.
Now, you mentioned crime being a serious problem. When you go out at night, what are you thinking?
Well, you know, most of the crime areas, let's face it, are where low-income people live. Uptown, where I now live, is not immune by any means. It's a concern. It's a real concern, especially when I'm alone. And unfortunately, New Orleans is very car-dependent, which is not a lifestyle I prefer. You know, I'm a New York Transit rider, but nevertheless, I come home at night and fortunately can park right in front of my house and get in pretty quickly. But I'm very conscious of what's going on around me. It's something to be concerned about.
The answer to crime is?
Oh, there are a lot of answers in the sense that, you know, until you start with a higher than minimum wage economy where people, I mean, $7.50 an hour, what family can live on two jobs at that price? They cannot even make it on paycheck to paycheck. So you need to start with a reasonable economy where all the hotels and most of the tourist businesses and a lot of local businesses depend on the low wage. I mean, some of the hotel chains get away with murder in New Orleans. They would never be able to, you know, do in other cities. So you need to start with a decent wage, and you need to invest in the industries and businesses that create living wage jobs, not just bed makers and vacuum cleaners. And you need programs that actually address the issues on a local level with the people in neighborhoods, some of which is already being done. But the fundamentals, and you know, there are programs that address neighborhood crime issues in terms of trying to deal with local gangs and all that kind of stuff. But it's not, you know, it's not going to take care of anything if the people you're trying to sort of get to not involve themselves in crime, if what's their alternative? A job that doesn't give them a living wage? You're forcing them to turn to the alternative economy just to, I mean, the story in one family, a kid turned to drug selling even temporarily to help buy the school uniform for his sister who was in a charter school. I mean, these are basic things. So if a family can't afford the things that are necessary to live a decent life, why not? Why not turn
to crime?
Why not?
Because you're going to go to prison for the rest of your life.
You know, they're ready for that. It's like they expect it. They expect to spend time in prison. And that's so sad when that's part of the expectation in one's life.
Indeed it is. The book is How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. We're Still Here, You Bastards. And it's by Roberta Branis Gratz. And it is a read that will really bring you up to date on what's happening in New Orleans. Roberta, thank you so much for spending all this time with us. We very much appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, Call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.